Good evening. Thank you all for being here. This is a pleasure. And there are cookies in the back. I wanted to start with what's most important before we begin. How many of you have tarot cards at home? Okay, that's most all of you. And how many of you use them frequently? Okay, slightly less. Okay, you've not yet opened the box, but you've got them at home. All right, well, that's good. So maybe by the end of this evening, you'll be more intrigued to open the box and start exploring.
Yes.
Okay. All right, well, I want to start with the question, what is the tarot? And start with the public perceptions of what the tarot is. Because I think that most people have any of four ideas about what the tarot is. And they are dark and creepy, scary, dangerous, an ill-advised tango with the occult, something to be avoided at all costs, dark, creepy vibe, or a scam, complete scam, unscrupulous, quote-unquote, psychics luring in the gullible to take terrible advantage. Ah. The entertaining, the wacky, the fun, the silly, and the completely incredible. The tarot that we find at overnights, Halloween parties, and corporate events. Harmless and entertaining tarot. Or how about even for people that are more familiar with the tarot, they might even have had tarot readings, but their understanding of the tarot is limited to it being a predictive tool that is purely for fortune telling. You know, will I get the job? Will I find true love? Will I marry Prince Harry? Those kinds of questions that they believe the tarot is strictly in service of. Now, there's good reason for all of these perspectives because it's all out there. You know, there's support for all of these different ways to see the tarot. And there are others, and it's my great pleasure tonight to discuss some of those other applications of the tarot. Here are just some of the ways, this is a partial list, this is what I could fit on the slide, of ways that tarot today is being used. Creativity enhancement, intuitive development, decision making, dream interpretation, spiritual guidance, meditation, visual affirmations, and self-discovery. But this list is, I would venture to say, unknown to the vast majority of people when you mention tarot, because they tend to think it's the first four things that we've looked at. So tonight we're going to look at the action figures, and I want to Before I go there, though, I want to show you a visual, because I think that tarot is visual, even though I'm going to be talking a lot about it, but I found a model, I found a single visual that for me sums up what this whole process is about, and it's called a Hoberman sphere, and here it is. You can get it at any toy store. This is our minds, our normal consciousness, day-to-day minds, rather dense, rather focused on the self and our own problems, self-absorbed. Yet when we step into a tool, when we use a tool such as the tarot among many tools, to expand our awareness, to get a larger perspective of ourselves, of our lives, of the person that we're working with, of those we love, we get a sense of lightness. We get a sense of returning to our own wholeness, and our perspective of ourselves and the world expands. And then we can go back to normal consciousness. But this is what draws me to the tarot, is this opportunity and invitation to expand in breath, expand in scope, and a pure sense of possibility. Love my Hoberman sphere, and this glows in the dark. This looks like a sea anemone if you palpate it. It's updated at night. It comes in different colors, too. So that really sums up how I see this whole process and this beautiful tool that is unfortunately so misunderstood. Now, the inspiration for this talk came this winter, the famous winter of 2014. And I found a tarot card that looks like a snapshot of this winter. There we have the Five of Pentacles. This talk is about the motion cards in tarot, the cards that show people in action, but this is hardly action. This is called trudging. This is barely getting by through a snowy, cold, frozen winter. It's a time of hibernation, winter is, yeah? It's a time when we go inward because there's no opportunity to go outward, really. We're stuck inside. And we can get very frustrated. And yet, we're now shifting that. We're changing. Springtime, soon summer. A sense of possibilities reemerge. Color reemerges. And we see people that have been within the walled city coming out with a feeling of celebration. Ah, stepping out into the beautiful yellow sunlight. Big contrast between where we've been. So this winter, I was thinking of a theme for the talk, and I thought I'd like to do something with the action figures, those images in the tarot that rather than showing stiff figures in austere poses, that show a sense of movement, where we see figures that are ready to go, if not already gone. And for the selection, I'm going to draw from what's called the Major Arcana. Here's a depiction of the Major Arcana that's 22 cards that tend to represent the soul-level invitations, the states and stages of consciousness. And I've picked out four that, for me, kind of jumped off the page. And here they are. The Fool, the Chariot, the Tower, and Judgment. And those are the four that we'll be talking about tonight in terms of what the movement is about, and what is the invitation for us in each of these archetypes. All right, so we begin with the Fool. There is a letter attributed to this, a Kabbalistic letter attributed to this in the Kabbalah, and that is Aleph. And Aleph means breath. And here the Fool is taking a really good one. And he'd better, because he's at the edge of a cliff. This card represents a moment of either outrageous foolishness or the most inspired divine trust we can imagine. We don't know how deep that cliff or gorge is, but the Fool doesn't seem concerned one way or the other, because the direction of the Fool is upward. And in the tarot, as in many other iconographies, the upward direction is the divine or the higher self. It's something aspirational. And here the Fool looks up as if to say, I'm about to step off here and I'm trusting that you're watching out for me. Although there are no guarantees. There are no guarantees. There's something, however, about the dog that many people find somewhat reassuring. The presence of a happy, yapping, white pup somehow removes this from any sense of doom. I think also the bright color, the sunshine, and yellow in this deck of cards. By the way, the cards we'll be looking at tonight go back to 1910. It still is the best-selling tarot deck since its publication. It's the Rider-Waite deck, or Rider-Waite-Smith. But that yellow of divine intelligence and that bright sun and that optimistic puppy seem to suggest that this leap of faith is okay, that we will come out intact. I love this as a symbol of spring and a symbol of summer reemerging, because it is really what we're doing, isn't it? We're hanging up the winter coats, putting them in storage, and stepping out into what we hope will be a wonderful experience, an unknown spring, a sense of adventure and becoming. I also love the fact that the fool is numbered zero. And there's a wonderful little reminder in this. Zero is nothing. And I like to think that that's an egoless state of this figure. Of all of the tarot archetypes, in fact, of all the tarot cards, the fool probably thinks less of himself, but not in a low esteem way, but just in a, I'm a human being, or I'm a being, and I'm taking each moment as it comes, and I don't really care what you think of me, and I don't really have any idea where I'm going. I'm here for the experience, much like the journey of the soul. In the esoteric tradition, this figure is seen to be walking into the physical experience from the other world. So this is all of us before we incarnate, the moment before incarnation, we're stepping into physical life, which is an awfully foolish thing to do. There are no guarantees. It is a tremendous risk. And yet, again, where does the gaze of the fool go? Upward. There's a wonderful line in Romeo and Juliet where Romeo is just lost and beckoning, and he looks up and he says, "He that hath the steerage of my course, direct my sail." He's imploring for guidance. Lead me in a direction that introduces me to something beautiful, meaningful, or that teaches me who I am. That's the experience of the fool. The mandalas, those round figures on the tunic of the fool, are references to a few things. One of them is completion. A circle is an item of, it's a symbol of completion. And the fool really is quite complete as he or she is. But there's still a desire for experience, a desire to learn more, to put him or herself into situations that are unfamiliar and perhaps exciting, perhaps rewarding in their own ways. There's a little correlation too that I love here, two of them. The dog is white, as is the rose that the fool holds. The boots of the fool are yellow, as is the sky. And there's an axiom called the Hermetic axiom, which is as above, so below. And as within, so without. Our sense that our earthly experience has some guidance, has some connection to the larger world or to the divine. That white flower is purity. It's the purity of intention. That's why this card is seen as the inner child. It is the innocence. The naivete as well, the untested part of ourselves that just wants to see what it's like to have that experience, pure and simple, without an agenda. Got a few examples. Surrendering to the moment, letting agendas and inhibitions go. When I was a small kid, I was probably 6 years old, I lived near a church, and the church had a big churchyard. One day I was playing near the church, and I saw a man, about his age, lying on his back in the churchyard. And I became alarmed. I'd never seen that. I lived in the suburbs. And I went to a neighbor lady, and I knocked on her door, and I said, "There's a man, and he's lying on his back in the churchyard." And I thought, well, maybe he's dead, or something's wrong. Well, she got into my energy and she became alarmed and she called the police. And I waited until the police showed up. They went over and they shook the man and he said, "Yay, what's up?" And the police said, "What are you doing?" He says, I'm napping. He said, "I just was lying on my back and the sky was so beautiful and I just wanted to hang out and fell asleep." And the cop was embarrassed. The woman was embarrassed. I was feeling really sheepish because I was the one that had, you know, pointed this out and made the report. And I never forgot that because I thought, you know, here's a guy that's just lying, enjoying the sky. no agenda, but that was suspect. That's odd. Someone just really stopping to smell the roses or to look at the sky. Here's another one. Pure fool energy. The invitation of the fool is for us to smile and laugh. And that's why I think that the key to that, being in that word aleph, which is the breath, we can't smile and we can't laugh if we're holding our stomachs, if we're holding our breath, if we're watching and waiting and gritting our teeth. Fool energy is that release. It's an open-armed, childlike, trusting release and jump. And fools and children and animals have a wonderful connection because animals too have no agenda. Animals love pure experience and they're playful. And sometimes that is the highest possible spiritual invitation we can respond to, especially if we're really in our heads and very, very, very intellectual and very analytical, zapping our lives of all the joy that's possible. So the fool says, lighten up. Don't take yourself so seriously. Case in point, the fool energy invites us to try new things, to open doors that we haven't before. And here we're seeing a couple of seniors who decided it might be fun to try fencing, even though they've got walkers, so what? Pure potential, pure fool willingness to try something and probably look foolish in the process. But the fool doesn't care because the fool just wants the fun of it, the experience of it. Love that image. And the last comparison I want to show you here is the King of Pentacles with the fool. This is a good one. If you buy a tarot deck, the fool is always the top card. And the card in the bottom is always the King of Pentacles because of the way that they're ordered. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about the King of Pentacles before we make this contrast. This king, it's a little hard to see in this image, but the king is a man or a person of tremendous means, a great deal of accomplishment in his life, particularly in the physical plane. This is often the retiree who has a nice savings and pension and is now able to just sit, enjoy, and relax and appreciate the fruits of his or her labors. And the opposite of that, on top of that deck, is the archetype that says, let's get things moving again. Let's shake up the status quo. Let's try stuff for the fun of it, and let's please get out of that chair. That's fool energy. So when we get too sedentary, too comfortable, too complacent, the fool is there to snub his nose and invite us to play, invite us to dance, because that's exactly what we need. As a tarot reader, I have the opportunity to read for people of all ages. And this combination is not uncommon with people who are retiring or retired. Because there's a sense of what's next? What's next? I'm comfortable, but I'm not terribly satisfied. I'm not feeling very creative or inspired. And often, the fool shows up somewhere in that spread to tweak them and get them having fun again and inspire them to take a class in something they've always wanted to but have never done, particularly if they take themselves very seriously and are terrified of looking foolish by trying and learning something new. Fool doesn't care. Fool's in it just for the experience. I want to share with you on that subject of retirement. This is an excerpt from my book, Tarot for Life. This is how the fool showed up in a client's reading. There are some readings that just stay with you. There are stories that stay with us that we never forget. And I'll never forget this woman. She had the fool show up in her reading, and it triggered a memory of a recent dream she'd had. She was an old blind beggar, and she was wandering in the dream through a dense forest with the aid of a dog. And a voice within the dream told her that if she would just pluck out the dog's eyes and put them in her own head, she would see. and horrified in the dream, she refused, and she woke up from the dream in tears. It was extremely upsetting to her. And I learned in the process of that reading from the client that, like the fool beggar in the dream, she was now, too, in a wandering place in her life. In her 60s and near retirement, she feared being directionless. She said, the wandering part makes sense, but what about the eyes? And I answered that I felt it was an inner urging to enter this phase of her life, this new phase of her life, with new eyes, with fresh eyes, with a different perspective. The dog's eyes promised faithfulness to the vision she had entered the forest to find. Were she to let her rational mind alone lead her, she'd never get out of the woods. So it's hard for me not to think of that when I see the fool in connection to someone who is standing at a crossroads in their life, and particularly people that have been fearful about letting go of their hyper-adult persona and are concerned about what it might look like if they just went off the deep end. I'd like to also share a personal story of how the fool spoke to me in a very, very profound way. I had a dream many years ago that I was changing the sheets of my bed. And in the center of the sheet was a cricket. And I was gathering up the four corners of the sheets. And my intention in the dream was, well, I'm either going to crumple up the cricket and kill it, or I'm going to set it free outside. And it disturbed me in the dream that I was so callous to even consider the first option of killing it. And that's what woke me out of the dream. And it was March. I'm at the top floor of a condo building in Chicago. I shuffled to the bathroom, and on the floor between the bathroom and the hallway was a dead cricket. Now, I had never seen a cricket in our home in all the years I lived there, and certainly not in March, when they're just not around. And the fact that it was dead got my attention. That morning, I did a tarot reading, and I said, what is the message of the cricket? The fool. And the connection I made is that the fool takes leaps as crickets leap. Crickets get about by leaping. And whether or not that's true, it made sense for me. And it made me instantly very sad because I felt like I had denied whatever part of me wanted so to leap. And I had held it back and was even smothering it in a sense. And that led to a series of inner discoveries that fortunately did get me leaping a bit. Although incrementally, it was nothing off the cliff. Wasn't anything quite so sudden. So, card of motion compared to the chariot. The chariot. Now, I love this comparison because here we're seeing the yellow boots of the fool and the yellow wheels of the chariot. But there's a key difference. These are both forms of conveyance. For the fool, the yellow boots are purely willy-nilly. They're for following instinct or intuition. But not so for the chariot. For the chariot, these wheels are purposeful. They go in a very specific direction that is steered with big intentions by the charioteer. So we go from, we'll see where this path leads, to I know what I want, I know where I'm going, and no one's going to stop me. Very different kind of energy. The chariot is the archetype of commencement. This is the victory card. You have arrived. And that's signified by the two sphinxes there that are holding their tails, which signifies completion. So they've arrived. On the other hand, this card could be about preparedness, readiness to go. And how you see that would really depend upon where this card appears in your reading. It would be very clear whether you've either completed your objectives or whether you are just starting out. And I'm kind of cheating a little by saying it's a card of action when it's clearly not moving. But the fact that it's the Chariot, you've got to give me some space there. I mean, really, it's the Chariot. And in many decks, we see a chariot that is racing, driven by horses, or driven by sphinxes, or by bats, depending upon the deck that you're working with. There's a lot of armor in this. There's a great deal of armor in this character. And, you know, the shadow side of armor is that we can be so armored that we are not emotionally available. We have our defenses up, not to be penetrated, and don't bother me. Talk to the hand. But there's another purpose, I feel, for the armoring of the charioteer. And that is, when you think of a time in your life, maybe it's now, when you have an idea or a dream or a goal that is so precious that you must protect it. Because if you were to share it with the wrong person, pew, they could shoot down that dream. They could ridicule that dream. They might question the integrity or the value or the monetary rewards of that dream. And it's their right to do that. But that can weaken our resolve, can't it? We've all been in that place where we regret having shared that dream with the wrong person. And we've got to withdraw. We need some armoring. And that is an important gift at that point for us as charioteers, is to know when we need to protect what's that important. This is really the card of being in the driver's seat of life. And I've got some symbols, some images that I think capture that really nicely. There's a sense of upward motion or ambition with the chariot. We're moving forward and probably moving up. Graduation, we are in the archetypal season of the chariot with all of the graduations around us this month. The chariot is competitive. It's the energy of achievement, of setting a goal and meeting it. It's meaningful action. It is acting with purpose. It is acting with discipline. And yet, there's a wonderful, odd little symbol in this card, and that is a very contradictory pose of those two sphinxes. They're facing in slightly different ways. Whoops, jumped my gun. Do you see how they're facing? Slightly. All right. This is a contradiction, and that can stop many of us from moving forward with our chariot sense of courage and determination. Because we start to think things like, well, you know, I'd really like to do that and pursue that, but this over here, I'm out. No, it's not going to work. And we tell ourselves that until everything is perfectly aligned, we're not going to take action. And then what happens? We never move. We're always in almost ready, but because we're facing in slightly different directions, we don't move. This charioteer, his or her spiritual quest is to figure out a way to integrate the contradictions and move anyway, despite the contradictions. It's yes and, not no but. It's yes and. I remember years ago when I first fell in love with the tarot, and I knew instantly, I couldn't wait to teach what I was learning. And I talked to a very wise friend of mine, and I said, you know, I picked up my first tarot book a couple years ago, and I have so many ideas for how to share this with people. But I said, you know, I'm new at this. There are people that are teaching this, have been doing it far longer than I have. And he listened, and he said, yeah, well, you know, as I see it, you've got a lot to learn and a lot to teach. Both. Thank you. Horses aligned. Straightforward. Or even slightly aligned. I still had misgivings. I was still thinking, really, though, I could screw up. I could, you know, what if I say something that's damaging and or wrong? And but that gave me the what, the go for it, to do that. It's also the maturity, I think, of contradictions, that we have to be able to hold in each hand the contradictions of our lives, right? That we are married to our best friend and our worst enemy, and somehow we make that work, to give a very extreme example. To be in a job that we really question its integrity, what we're doing there, and yet it is feeding our large family. How do we make that work? And this is not to get into right or wrong, but the pure energetic fact that we are all wrestling to keep on track despite these contradictions that come to us as human beings. I have a story to share with you about the chariot that is so unrelated to goals and things like that, and that's why I want to share it, because it's such a departure. One of my tarot students, Elizabeth, years ago, wrote me an email. And she'd been doing tarot readings in class for only a couple weeks, but she said that her 19-year-old cat, Emily, was showing signs of failure. And she and her sister were thinking this might be it. But Elizabeth consulted the cards, and she said, "Is Emily ready to go? Chariot. Yeah." She said that this card gave her the courage, and it validated her own gut feelings that this was time for her little cat to move on. Again, the theme of commencement, of being ready to move forward. Ready to move forward, whether that is from this life, or into the job, or into the entrepreneurial venture, or into the vacation in Switzerland, whatever it is that has us wanting to have all systems go. The chariot. We're going to change the energy a bit, because we've just entered tower territory. We should have music cued for that. Steve, do we have any foreboding music? No? Okay. All right, well, the tower. This is when things fall apart in an instant. Lightning strikes a tower, two people fall out, it doesn't look good, and we, again, just like the fool's cliff, we have no idea really how deep that is, that fall will be for them. That lightning blast has knocked off a crown at the top of the tower. It is nighttime. There are these mysterious yellow things, like leaves, that surround the falling couple. And what's going on here? There's even a fire in the tower, we can see there, because of the lightning. Well, to start with the most mundane or ordinary way that this card shows up in readings is the sudden news we get that changes everything. Here are some examples. You're fired. We've been robbed. Darling, I've been seeing someone else, and I'm leaving you. I have your X-ray results. These are the life-changing sorts of one-liners that can completely upset our sense of being safe and grounded and firm in the world, and send us toppling out of that tower. And there's not a one of us who hasn't had one or two or three or more tower experiences. It is part of being a human being, as it is with all the archetypal experiences in the tarot and beyond. They are about us. They live in us, and if we haven't yet had some of them, we probably will. But the tower is known to any of us who have had any instant bad news or even had an embarrassing moment. Because embarrassment and humiliation is also a teaching tool of the tower. If we take ourselves too seriously, it's almost like the fool has whispered to the tower saying, "Hey, maybe a little embarrassment, just so they don't take themselves so seriously. They're not so full of themselves." And then we get that tower fall. the most obvious sorts of tower experiences we see in nature, the destructive aspects of Mother Nature. You know, it's just a fact of being on the planet, and there we have it. One day your house is doing great and you've got expensive vases on your shelf, and the next moment there's an earthquake and you've got a tower experience. How about economics? The tower has shown up in our economy big time as the archetype of plummeting, of downfall, of failure. And stocks fall and confidence plummets. All of those analogies apply when we're talking about the tower. I like the fact, too, that on the one on the top right, it's almost like lightning there, too, has knocked those stocks down. And scandal. Scandal is a huge, huge expression of the tower. And what happens with a scandal? What are the dynamics of a scandal? Well, you've got somebody that has built a tower of a reputation for themselves. There's a certain persona that they presented that has given them some currency in the world. And then when a truth is leaked, something is unveiled, that tower collapses and it's not easy to recover. So here's some fine and I think recognizable examples right there. If you also think of the word facade, because a building has a facade, and so do we when we are not being authentic. And there's something in a facade that wants to crack, apparently, at least when we're in the world of the tower. Another thing I found when I was doing some looking into about the tower is that it's often referred to as an apocalypse. This is interesting. The Greek word apokalypsis means to unveil, which suggests to me that this is a stripping away of defenses. And I've got some illustrations for that. This is the La Maison Dieu. This is a French version of the tower, and the deck dates back to the 18th century. And the tower was called the House of God. An odd choice, it would seem. And yet, that really gets at the core of what the spiritual invitation or possible message of this destructive force called the tower is. Charles West has a quote that I think works beautifully here. He said, "We turn to God for help when our foundations are shaking, only to find it is God who is shaking them." So that the structures that we felt were solid and real may not be. We might have been building a tower of illusion. And we often don't know that until that tower falls and the light comes in and we're standing in the rubble and we're able to see that, oh my gosh, I bought it hook, line, and sinker. And yet something is unveiled in that apocalypse form of the word. So how could the tower possibly be redemptive? How could it be transformative for us? Here's a cartoon I like of a guy that is creating his own prison. No one guarding him, right? That seems to be a completely self-created prison that he's in. Poor guy. There's a corollary in the tarot, and she is the Eight of Swords. This is a woman that also is restricted in some way, but if you look closely at the card, she has very loose binds. This cloth that she wears is so loose, it could shimmy right off with the right move. There are also no guards around her, nor do the swords surround her. There's nothing really penning her in, but she's blindfolded, so apparently she thinks that she is limited. She thinks that she is locked in, just like the guy in the previous cartoon. In a way, we all are this card. We all are this archetype because we believe that the world we see is the world as it is. But we can only see the world as we see it, which has necessarily limitations. And if we have a negative view of the world, that will color everything just as a positive view of the world. But if you're like most people, we don't have a positive or negative. We have a mix, right? We just live our lives as human beings, and we vacillate between the two and sometimes have both at once. So, what if the only thing that could shock us out of our complacency with our blindfolds and our self-imposed prisons is a tower experience? Sometimes it takes a tower to get our attention. Now, ideally, and if we looked at the other tarot cards, particularly in the major arcana, we'd see that a large teaching of the tarot is to move consciously through life so that we don't necessarily need the harsh awakenings, that we can get it through a more organic or natural, effortless way if we're aware. But tower experiences tend to be the 2x4 over the head that afterward we go, oh, why didn't I see that coming? How many times do I need to get that message? That's the tower. You know, it's interesting because I think that we create towers sometimes to remove ourselves from others so that we can become closer to the divine up here. But the irony is that the divine is down here. And the people we're trying to get away from are the divine. And those are the people we've built the tower to get away from. And sometimes it needs to come back full circle and we're back down to earth. This is the cracking up of the psyche, or at best, if we can be in a tower experience with eyes open, it could be a cracking open. It could be a cracking open, where instead of a sense of complete betrayal and a rubbling of our trust in life, it could be a cracking open into something deeper. Something deeper. I want to share with you an experience I had in college, which, as I can track it, was my first tower experience. And I was a theater major in school, and I went through 4 years of enjoying nice parts in the shows, being fairly popular, and I got cast in a play my senior year called The Children's Hour by Lillian Hellman. And I played Joe, the doctor. And in the play, Joe discovers that the woman he's supposed to marry is involved in a scandal. And it scares him, and she, in a very intense crisis scene, begs him to leave her to make it easier on him. Well, I read the script, I got cast, all's well, I'm in rehearsals. And I'm realizing that I'm required to feel something in this role. Prior to that, my roles had been character roles. Lots of posing and accents and comedy, where you can hide a lot of facade. Not this role. In this part, I was expected, required to show something of myself. And I was completely unprepared for that. And the rehearsals were excruciating for me because the director, I could see him frustrated watching the rehearsals, and he'd stop the rehearsal and he'd say, are you capable of feeling anything up there? I'm seeing this guy walking around who's reciting lines, but I'm not getting any sense of connection with you in this role. Show us something, please. Now, his approach was very harsh, and it stung, particularly because in the cast were a lot of underclass, I'm talking about underclassmen. I don't mean like lower class people I could barely spend my time with. No. And it was very embarrassing for me to be singled out and in such a critical way, because I was kind of hot stuff, And I enjoyed being like, ooh, you know, Paul Quinn, he's kind of cool. He's had these parts. And here I am with the younger people that are admiring me. All that really went very far for me at that time. Had a lot of currency. And now I was being humiliated. And I was getting very scared. And after one particularly brutal rehearsal, where the director just rode me the entire time, he ended the rehearsal before it was scheduled to end. And he said, everyone, go home. Go home. Paul, you stay. And he said, after the place had cleared, he said, I don't know what you're doing. You're ruining this play. You got to find some feeling. You better pull it up from somewhere because you are really, really bringing the show down. Figure it out. And then he left. So here I was in a theater in the round with what they call the ghost light. That's one lamp on the stage. That's the sole source of light. Everyone had left. And there I was. And what happened is I cracked open. I cried. I cried, I bawled, I keened, I wailed. I was on my knees. It was positively operatic. And the tears did not stop. Ugly tears, heaving, gasping for breath tears. And at the end of it, I felt great. Because my tower collapsed, I was exposed to be very human, and it confirmed for myself that I had the very depth of feelings that was required of the character, but more importantly, I found it for myself. And the next morning, tears that night, in fact, that night, I called my folks and said, please do not come to the play. Don't come. And cried more on the phone. The next day, I went to an acting class, and I got there early, and I was just, my eyes were swollen. And something really lovely happened. One of my classmates, a guy named Rick Sheingold, looked at me, and without any judgment, but almost a sense of appreciation, he said, wow, your eyes look like they've been swimming. And I felt seen. I felt like it was okay to feel, to cry, to have evidence of tears, and still be okay. So that, for me, was a tower experience, but a redemptive one in that I was able to come out of that feeling actually more vital, more alive, and more grounded than I had been when I was in this brittle tower of facade and posing and humor and things that I relied on to be liked. So something more authentic got revealed. All right, to go to the next card, judgment, another card of motion. That's kind of an abrupt segue, isn't it? I'm just feeling like, wait, I'm still back in the theater right now. I'm still back on that stage. Judgment. First of all, let's get out of the way that this is not about judgment, that it's not about you lived a good life, you did not. In fact, I don't find the word is really useful at all in the understanding of the card in terms of its spiritual invitation. Here we see people that have been in coffins. These may be the dead. They're gray, certainly. And they're hearing a call from an angel. You can read the angel as their higher self, perhaps. And they've been awakened from a slumber by a being that is asking them to come awake, to be alive, to get out of the boxes of habit, of limitation, of fear. Can you see a corollary with the tower already? Both are stone structures that are greatly limiting the expression of being authentic, being alive. And now it's a bit more gentle. There's an angel rather than a crack of lightning bringing things down. And something else very nice is happening here. It's not just one person that's awakening. It's a community. The idea here is that if any one of us awakes to who we are, in that process, we can't help but ripple the waves of awareness in others. That the act of waking up is a gift we give back to humanity. That sounds large, and it shouldn't. I don't mean it to sound grandiose, but it's a spiritual principle that when one changes, it affects the whole in some way. And here we're seeing it beautifully realized in the characters in Judgment. They're waking up. There's also seven blasts, seven radiant things coming out of that trumpet. Radiant things. What's a better word for radiant things? What's that? Oh, yeah. So these blasts of the trumpet, seven of them. Seven could be the seven chakras. That, wow, when we awake to our authentic selves or our higher selves or our more creative selves, what if we're activating all seven chakras? What if we are becoming aligned in a way we hadn't when we were stuck in the slab? There's a sense of newness and rebirth. And by the way, Renaissance means rebirth. And that's what's happening here. They are being reborn. I'm just checking some of my notes here. I'm not missing anything, but the word I'd written down was calling. This is the card of the calling. We all have one. We probably have several. Sometimes a calling comes but once, and if we haven't heard it, it doesn't come again. And sometimes the same call is very patient and will be with us for a very long time, waiting for us to rise up and accept it, step up to it, to wake to it, to recognize it, and to answer it, because calls must be answered. I did a tarot reading for my sister many years ago, in which this card showed up in a position in the spread that was, I forget what, it was something to do with parts forgotten or roads not taken, something like that, and it was Judgment. And so when I told my sister what Judgment was about, this calling, I said, what calling have you not acted on? Three Kleenexes later, lots and lots of tears. She had wanted to get into an intuitive line of business where she would be an intuitive consultant. She had been a hairstylist and did very well, but she wanted to follow this call to be present for other people in a way that was intimate and healing and spiritual. And she kept putting that aside. Well, I don't think I'll make enough money. I'm not ready. Who am I? Who am I to take on such a calling? That's another big thing. It's the who am I that will keep us in those boxes forever. Just as the voice for the charioteer that held him back was, yeah, but things aren't perfect, you know. The voice here is, who do you think you are? That's a mighty grand attitude. Oh, you think that's your calling? Well, I'm sure it's a lot of people's calling, but you think that's yours? Okay. That too can keep us back, scurrying back into the boxes. The card of awakening. I would intuit that everyone in this room right now has both a call you've acted on at some point in your life, as well as one that's nagging. There's a box with a lid partly opened where you can just peek out, but an angel wants attention. The angel of your own higher self or your deepest and wisest and most creative and most loving self. That's angel judgment, having nothing to do with judgment as we know it. In fact, it could be a freeing from the prison of being judgmental about ourselves or other people. And that's the most positive spin I can put on judgment, the word itself. This is the invitation to raise our vibration. So, flash mobs. Beautiful expression, I think, of judgment. Here we're seeing the collective. We're seeing masses of humanity rising up to say, isn't it great that we're connected? Isn't it great that we have music? Isn't it great that we can dance? That we can just celebrate how fun it is and wonderful and uplifting to come together in community and celebrate what it is to be a human being, to celebrate the spirit, and to be fools. It's a nice fool connection here. Judgment, the rising up, let's get out of the apartment, let's go and let's dance. Let's do a flash mob. And what happens when you see a flash mob? Do any of you cry when you see flash mobs? I do. I find them so moving to see seas of humanity. Did you see the one in Russia? You see this dark Russian winter and all of these people deliriously happy and joyful dancing through the streets. It's magnificent. I find it an affirmation of the human spirit, a celebration of the spirit. Pure judgment. Angel up there summoning, sounding the trumpet, and people rising up and responding. Beautiful thing. Four archetypes out of 78 we've talked about tonight. The fool, once that winter thaws and we're seeing a little bit of the ice caps behind the fool, it's time to dive into experience. What is it that you want to experience because you think it would be fun or it could be adventurous, maybe even a little risky? The chariot, finding the purpose, your purpose. What needs your discipline and your commitment at this time in your life? What needs your discipline and your commitment? And what needs to be protected? The tower, what is false that's ready to be cast out? And judgment, what part of you is waiting to push away the slab and respond to an invitation that expands you, like the Hoberman sphere, place of normal, dense consciousness, watchful, cautious, separate to breathing, feeling the lungs expand, feeling a sense of perspective enlarge, a sense of wholeness return, and a porousness in which light can enter freely. Thank you.
Do you think that different decks have different energies?
Do different decks have different energies? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like going into an art exhibit. One artist will make you feel one way and another artist another way. And you will spend more time in the gallery that makes you feel more intrigued, more enriched, or maybe even disturbed if that's what you're responding to.
We were traveling in, and I found this old deck, but it gave me the creeps. I didn't want to keep it around. It seemed very dark to me. Mm-hmm. It just didn't feel right.
Yeah.
And that's just the way I responded to it.
Right. Well, I would say that is trusting your gut. And that deck doesn't work for you.
Yeah.
I have a friend that liked the Thoth deck, that's T-H-O-T-H. And she said a friend of hers really liked the deck, but that strikes many people as a dark deck. It's not warm and friendly and sunny like this deck that we've looked at tonight. But her friend said he liked it because when he picked it up, it growled at him.
Well, yes.
Now that's interesting. That appealed to him. To me, that would be a deal breaker. But yeah, there's no right or wrong with decks. It's very much a matter of what suits you and what you respond to. Yeah, thank you. Paula.
Well, you left us hanging with your two stories. One, what happened with the play.
Yeah.
And two, did your sister change her career path.
She did. She absolutely did. And she's been doing something called SRT for the last 15 or so years. It's spiritual response technique. And so she is doing that. She heard the call and she responded, finally. Yeah. And you want to know about the play? Mm-hmm. Oh, it was terrible. I mean, actually, I was terrible. No, I never found my footing in that show. Never found it. I might have given a little bit more than before my crying jag, but no, it was disastrous for me as an actor, triumphant as a human being.
Oh, thank you. I came a little late, but I have heard you talking about these cards before. I don't know if you have read or studied the story or legend of Parsifal.
This medieval. Holy fool.
Yes, so it really reminds me of this path of initiation, so to speak, that this character has throughout this story and how it relates to this sequence of these things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's Arthurian legends, Norse legends, yes. Mythology at large. These are archetypal energies in those stories.
When did these cards came into being? Was it a parallel around this time in history?
We're talking
when
19,
was that
1910.
1910?
Yeah.
Oh, that's not that old.
Right.
Huh. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because also the symbolism of the tower makes me think about the fairy tales archetypal.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when you go into this tower, a lot of transformation happens there,
mm-hmm.
and you meet your true self. You know, it's that union that happens in this tower, and then you come down, and mm-hmm. of course, there is a transformation in between,
mm-hmm.
and there is that cracking of that personality.
Mm-hmm.
The harder the personality, the harder is the burst,
right.
You know? And that is the lightning of this higher ego that does meet you up there, your consciousness.
Yeah, right. Which is a freeing agent.
Yes,
it is. To get us out of that prison.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, that's brilliant. I really, really like this.
Thank you.
I'm not tarot fond, but I can relate with the symbolism of it.
This is probably a whole other talk, but I was wondering if you could briefly give a history of tarot, even the word tarot. I
first not for mass consumption when they first appeared in Italy. Mm. Yeah. I like saying smooth, bejeweled hands. I want some. The French shortened tarocchi to tarot, and that's where we get tarot. And I think any pronunciation is acceptable except for tarot, which John Lennon actually used, but I do forgive him. Yeah, tarot or tarot, but yeah, that's where the word comes from. In terms of histories, though, fascinating, and you're absolutely right, is a whole different talk. And I am not an expert on history. There are people within the tarot community who are tarot scholars who can take you very, very far back with tremendous detail, and they're also very good storytellers. So, yeah, I can recommend some books for you if you'd like after we close.
I'm mostly interested in...
Oh, wait, we're going to get a mic for you.
I'm mostly interested in how, did the Italian game include these archetypes?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just the fascination of people looking at themselves through this means, and that's...
And you had to be very wealthy. This was a card game for the nobility because all of these tarot decks were commissioned by artists of the day and done by hand. That's 78 cards. That's a very expensive commission. So, these cards passed through smooth, bejeweled hands of the nobility. These were not for mass consumption when they first appeared in Italy. Yeah, I like saying smooth, bejeweled hands. I want some.
I'm just wondering how you do readings for yourself and how often, without telling yourself what you want to hear,
mm-hmm.
and how often can you do readings for yourself?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a good question. How can you do readings for yourself? The whole idea of the tarot is to be objective pictures of what's going on. Pardon me. And I will say that it helps to do a little bit of detaching ritual. One simple way to do that is to talk about yourself in the third person. So in other words, I could say, I'm now going to do a reading for Paul about this question Paul has. And I ask for divine guidance. I ask for assistance from unseen, loving energy to guide Paul in this matter. And that gives me just a little distance so that I can hopefully read more objectively. Does that always work? No. If I'm really invested in an outcome, I really want those cards to say yes or no. It's harder. And then the best thing to do is to walk away and not read, I think. Yeah. Thank you. Good question.
Well, this is just a quick question. What is your favorite deck? I know you like to use the weight deck because it is a standard deck, but... And I thought, I heard you say one time that you might be getting a little tired of this particular deck and you might want to use another deck. Am I wrong in saying
no,
that?
No, no. I don't think I could ever get tired of the Rider-Waite-Smith, but I also use a deck called the Alchemical Tarot by Robert Place, which is wonderful. Great, vivid, stark images. Just love it. And I do use that as well. But I love this one because of the richness of the symbols. There's all, particularly when reading for other people, Ron, because people find so many things in the images that are meaningful to them, not even necessarily to me, but they'll pick up on a bird in one image. And then the reading goes in the direction of what that bird means to them. And that's what's exciting about it. It's almost like the more symbols in one image, the deeper you can go. The more doors that can open. And I do love the deck for that reason.